From Variety, celebrating 115 years covering the business of entertainment, this is the Award Circuit podcast.
No, because it's not that I don't trust my friends. It really, to be honest, like it's such a huge part of my life. It's even when I was a kid, at the time, I wasn't like making movies or anything. You know, I hear stories of people when they're kids, they're using little VHS and Super 8 making films. No, my creative outlet was drawing comic books and manga and writing fan fiction and putting them online and getting feedbacks, you know, and feeling like, oh, I can connect with someone else through telling a story.
Chloe Zhao still writes fan fiction, but she's come a long way from the days of live journaling. I'm Jazz Tanke, and on this edition of the Variety Award Circuit podcast, we talk to Chloe Zhao about her film Nomadland. The film became an early Oscar favorite after bowing at the Venice Film Festival earlier this year, and could see her make history as the first Asian American female to win the Best Director prize. We talked about what interested Zhao in making an American Westworld movie, as well as her new friendship with star Frances McDormand. She also reveals the challenge of juggling Nomadland while also working on Marvel's The Eternals. And later in the show, a conversation with Broadway veteran Ariana DeBose, who is now the star of Netflix's The Prom. But first, our awards roundtable asks, how many Best Picture nominations can Netflix get? It's all on this edition of Variety's Award Circuit podcast, so stay close.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Variety Award Circuit podcast. I'm Clayton Davis, Film Awards Editor, here today with Janelle Riley.
Hey, I got my morning DJ voice on.
Ooh, Jazz Tankang.
Hey, I do not have my morning DJ voice.
And he called out of work today, Mike Schneider. He's not here.
How dare he? Who will do our effortless segues?
I don't know. I guess I'm going to have to take up the reins there. I'm really sorry about that, but I'm going to do my best to up the mantle.
You will be temporary master of the universe.
Yeah. Happy Thanksgiving, belated Thanksgiving. How's everyone's time with family or by themselves, whichever one ended up happening?
It was lovely. I actually caught up on some movies, but not Hillbilly Elegy.
You still didn't watch it.
I still haven't watched. There's part of me that is like dreading seeing it because then I'm going to have an opinion on it.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's best to stay out of it right now.
That's sort of how I feel. It's like, what if I like it? People are going to think I'm an idiot. What if I hate it? I could also do the unthinkable, which is just not bother to give my opinion to anyone. I don't know why I think people care.
Yeah. Jazz, how was your Thanksgiving?
It was very good. It was just Jenna and myself, and we ate a lot. I got her into The Mandalorian. I'm so proud of that.
That's awesome.
But yes, we also watched The Prom and some other films. But
yep,
I watched a lot. I watched like Happiest Season, Superintelligence, which everyone told me was like so terrible, and I kind of enjoyed it.
Yeah, I was like, I haven't watched it.
Yeah,
that's good.
And yes, of course, The Prom, which was delightful. I can't remember any of the songs really, but the film itself was actually very delightful.
Yeah. I think there's your first segue. The Prom screened widely for critics. It was on Sunday. And followed by Q&A. And the reception was exactly as I predicted, because I think musicals by nature are just divisive, because some people just, if you hate musicals, there's not, I don't think there's one that's going to change your like stance on it.
Right.
And also, this is a very, very happy movie. And if you're not into that, it's it can be a really, really hard time for you.
If you enjoy pain, you're not going to like this movie.
Yeah, it's the polar opposite of Requiem for a Dream. That's what I like to say. Think about that.
I thought it was
utterly delightful. I thought it did exactly what it kind of set out to do. I think one of the things that I want to make abundantly clear, and while Meryl Streep is Meryl Streep and she is fantastic, this movie is utterly stolen from her by newcomer Joellen Pelman and Ariana DeBose.
I disagree.
I love Joellen. I think
Ariana DeBose. She's a star. Yeah.
I love them both. They were so good. And you were right. They did steal from the Queen, Meryl. I'm just going to say that.
Coming from Jazz
herself. It's so colorful, right? It's everything that Mank isn't, or like Requiem for a Dream. It's just utterly delightful. And I think, like you said, if you like the play, if you like the musical on Broadway, you're going to love the adaptation that Ryan Murphy's done. And if you don't like musicals, there's just no hope.
This is not for you.
Yeah. Can I just say, I mean, all the actors are great. They're all such a delight. Keegan-Michael Key, first of all, holds his own with Meryl Streep. I ship those two so hard. There's so much joy in that performance. And I know that that small town high school principal who on spring break goes to New York and packs in as many Broadway shows as possible. He's just delightful. And apparently with this and Jingle Jangle, carving out a little niche for himself in these feel-good musicals.
Yeah, he's very, very talented. And I really hope this continues to lead him to better, bigger, more substantial roles, because I think there is still an untapped... The performance in him that is going to kick him into some serious territory.
And he needs to get his own Oscar so that he and Jordan Peele can have matching Oscars. Oh, yeah. Yes.
And they just start dueling with each other with their Oscars.
They're dueling Oscars, yeah.
Can I just say Kerry Washington singing just blew me away. I did not expect her to have pipes at all. And I was like, whoa, Kerry, you're so good. I didn't even know this.
Oh, well, you know, she was in the Heights originally. Yeah, she goes way back with Lin-Manuel Miranda. I don't know if she actually did the Broadway production or she did a workshop or something, but like, yeah, she's got the chops. And so, she's amazing.
So let me ask, because I was on this island by myself because I had saw the film before Sunday about a best picture. No, but in regards to the
just
best picture.
Just so you all know, Clayton saw it first.
No,
for those of you
this
keeping
is,
track.
This is why predicting sucks sometimes, because you're doing stuff in your predictions and people are like, where are you getting this feeling from? And this is why I've had the prom in best picture. I think it's going to hit a cultural zeitgeist with kids and teenagers, aka the kids and teenagers of Oscar voters, that's going to be playing in their house all December. And I just feel like I think it's going to be an 8-9er. Like, I don't think it's going to contend to win at all, but I think it's going to do well. And I can see it doing very well at the Globes. Like,
oh yeah,
I see it getting maybe like 6 or 7 Globe nominations. Nicole Kidman, by the way, is a total Globe nominee. Like, I feel it in my bones, and maybe it won't go anywhere past that, but I feel like Zsasz, which, by the way, for anyone who didn't read the piece, was the last thing they filmed before they got shut down. And it was the day they found out that Tom Hanks had coronavirus.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I spent a lot of the movie going like, I wonder why Nicole Kidman took this role. Like, she's good, you know, and it's a fun movie, but what was in it for her? And then you get to her number and I was like, aha,
that's why.
That's it. Yeah.
I agree. I think this is like a dark horse. I think people are going to love this. It's just because it's everything that every other film isn't. Like, it's so joyful. It's so happy. And you just feel so happy when you're watching it for 2 hours. You forget about everything that's going on around you. And I think it's going to become like a viral sensation on TikTok. And that's going to filter down into, you can't escape it.
Good.
I was gonna say, maybe Wear Your Crown will become a best original song contender. And
and the thing is, I think it tops out picture, original song. I think Meryl's probably good for almost to get in
for an actress, Oscar.
I think she's gonna win the Globe, and if she loses the Globe, then I will concede that maybe she doesn't go the way of Oscar, but her competition in the Globe category will probably be Michelle Pfeiffer,
unless they make Carrie Mulligan. Look, that's a segue.
Segue. Sorry. There you go. No, really? Look at you. Promising young woman.
Yeah. Which should not. I mean, I should say that people are speculating it will go in the comedy category. I don't think it will. That would really send the wrong message, I think. Although it has, you know, darkly funny.
I know. And I think I've been so weary of speaking about it like that. Like, if it went comedy, for us who have seen the movie, it's not a terrible categorization, but you're opening yourself up to all the clickbait headlines that are going to be, I didn't know rape was funny. And that's where it's going to go. So they're better off just staying drama. But comedy is not inappropriate. I mean, it's a dark comedy. It ends in a very dark place. But it is a dark comedy.
I just think they really need to nominate real true comedies in the comedy category.
I agree with that.
And it does not fit in there.
Do you remember when they called Her a comedy? Let's all remember that. Her is a comedy.
I will say I find Her more a comedy than Promising Young Woman.
Really?
There's a sweetness and a lightness to it that's built like a rom-com.
Okay.
You know, where he's falling in love with this girl who happens to be AI.
I laughed one time in that movie, and that's the Kristen Wiig, like, phone love-making moment at the beginning of the movie.
At least you remember laughing. I don't even remember laughing at that. So, yeah. No, Promising Young Woman is more of a dark comedy than Her is even a comedy, which still blows my mind, but...
Yeah, I agree. It's not, it shouldn't have been categorized as comedy, but I see it more than Promising Young Woman.
So what do we think Promising Young Woman is going to do? Because, I mean, I think Carey Mulligan, and now I've kind of deemed this term out there. She's in one nomination, Purgatory. It's been almost it's been over a decade since she's been nominated, which is bananas. She's not the president of that Purgatory. Jake Gyllenhaal is. Jake Gyllenhaal also doesn't have a second nomination, which is bananas.
Which is crazy.
There are a lot of people who are in this boat. But I feel like it could break her way, depending on if the actors branch really starts going in for Meryl Streep, Sophia Loren, and Michelle Pfeiffer.
Honestly, I think Carey Mulligan has a better shot than all three of those, with the possible exception of Michelle Pfeiffer.
That's good.
Yeah. Go ahead, sorry.
No, I was going to say, I think Carey, people will like this. Like, it will stick with them because I think I told you this was the last one I saw before the lockdown. Her performance has stuck with me this whole time. Like, it is that good, and you don't think about it. And then somebody says Promising Young Woman, Carey, or you'll see a clip and you're like, wow, she was actually really, really good in this. So I think
And it's unlike anything we've seen her do.
Yeah.
Or like anything else really this year.
I'd argue this could be. I think this is her best work yet. I come to Wildlife and Shame a lot when I think of her, but this is really close. This is like definitely upper stuff that she's. I think this is definitely better than what she did in Education.
Yes, but I am a big fan of her performance in Wildlife and actually Suffragette, which get any love. Yeah.
Poor girl.
She's fantastic.
Yeah, at this time of writing, she's sitting number four in the Best Actress rankings, and I think that's a good spot for her. What do you think this goes in a picture race, though? Because that's where I've struggled to see because this also feels like a Brooklyn situation. Picture, actress, maybe original screenplay, but that could just be it.
It's not going to get director, right? I don't see...
By the way, I'm sure everyone knows, but the director of Promising Young Woman, Emerald Fennell, is playing Camilla Parker Bowles on The Crown and slaying it.
Is she?
That blew my mind. Yeah,
she's so good.
I did not know.
She is so good. I was like, wait, she was on The Crown, and this is her directorial debut, which is crazy.
Yeah, she's having a year.
And I like the movie very much. I think her direction is way stronger than the script. And I think that's where it's going to kind of end up being her, where she'll get recognized as in screenplay. But her direction, I mean, that movie is colorful and bold. Like, I hope that they will consider costumes, because I think that nurse outfit is going to be a staple of our future in a lot of ways.
And hair and makeup.
I think I have it in hair and makeup, actually. Yeah, I do have it in hair and makeup. And it has two original songs. I think they're in the running right now as well. They're going to be submitted. So it could do well, but it does. In that picture, 5% of the Academy has to put it number one. That's where I always keep coming back to. Like, do they do that? If it was a year of straight 10, which is next year, 100% this movie would be in, no questions asked. But Emerald, I think, is going to be now one of the top front runners now for DGA first time feature with Regina King. Like, that is going to be, I think we're going to have another woman win that.
Oh, fantastic.
Wow.
Which is
That's going to be awesome.
Yep. Any other tidbits, thoughts on Promising Young Woman? How promising it is?
Well, no, I was just going to say, you talk about the colors and I love the production design of it because like all the pink and the warmth and everything just suggests one thing and the film's totally not that, which is such a smart thing of her to do. And I don't know if she'll get director for that. Right. But.
And then last topic on the list here is discussion of Best Picture, but in relation to an article that that I did some research for about possibly Netflix breaking a record long held by MGM as having the most Best Picture nominees in a category in 1930. I call it 1936. So that's when the films were released. I hate that we don't refer to these years correctly, but
yeah, it makes you crazy.
1936 Oscars, which was held in 1937. MGM had 5 Best Picture nominees that year. Great Ziegfeld won. And then it was also nominated alongside Liable Lady, Romeo and Juliet, San Francisco, and A Tale of Two Cities. Netflix could be in a position to tie or break that record. Does the streamer, the new kid on the block, get to do that? And the closest, by the way, we've ever gotten to that being broken was in 2002. Harvey Weinstein got 4. Chicago, The Hours, The Pianist, and Gangs of New York. And he was an executive producer on Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers. So he dominated that category in theory. But what do you guys think? Obviously, the big 2 that everyone feels good about, that Mank and Trial of Chicago 7 will probably be there. Do you not feel that way, Janelle?
I'm not confident of anything. Really? I have no idea what people are thinking. You know, normally you can be out and about and talk to people at screenings and get a feel for the room, but I just don't know. That's I really don't. I think Pieces of a Woman actually has a good shot at a Best Picture nom.
Yeah.
Maybe that's crazy.
Maureen.
I don't know. Yeah,
we spoke about.
I really don't know.
Well, going through this piece by piece real quick. Mank is probably the leading Netflix contender. Can we all like acknowledge that? I think that's like.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Absolutely.
Trial of Chicago 7 keeps smelling to me like the movie that's nominated for Best Picture and Sorkin misses director, and everyone's like, why? But it also could be like, oh yeah, of course it does. So we don't know there. So that could do some damage in Best Picture. That would be 2. Then Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, I think, is their third tier contender.
Mm-hmm.
And by third tier, not means necessarily third tier, but I think it feels good. I think the stat I acknowledge to that, last 50 years, 10 actors won Best Actor without their films being nominated for Best Picture. In the last 20 years, only 3 have. So if your thought is Chadwick Boseman's going to win Best Actor, pretty good bet you have to assume that the film's getting nominated for Best Picture as well. You have any?
And like it or not, let's not forget Hillbilly Elegy. A lot of people really liked it. As predicted. We predicted critics wouldn't and audiences would like it more.
Do you think it's extremely loud and incredibly close, like kind of surprise thing that maybe just makes it in? Or like what do you think it does if it were to get in?
I should really see the movie.
Janelle, you have a week to watch it.
I know. And the thing is, I have a feeling I'm going to like it. So,
And can I just say, by the way, like, I still acknowledge that the performances are, like, I think Amy Adams and Glenn Close are really good in it because they're good actresses. So it's hard to not like them. It's just everything that happens around them is what is problematic.
The one that I actually think people might be sleeping on is The Midnight Sky. Everyone I know who has, are we allowed to talk about it? Sorry.
I think we can acknowledge that we saw it. Yeah, we can talk about that.
I think we can acknowledge that it's a play.
Yeah,
I think it's a play. And that everyone I know who has seen it has like really liked it. And like, I think it's coming in as something that they're just sort of being like, hey, it's just fun entertainment. But it's very, I'm trying to be careful here. But I'll just say that like, I would not count that
one. I would say it's the biggest thing that George Clooney has ever done in terms of scope of what he's made in terms
as
of
a director.
As a director.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
It is, I think when you create a film that is going to be a big tech player, and I think this 100% will be in production design, sound, visual effects, score. I think it's one of the front runners for score. Desplat has created one of his best things there yet, and he has Steven Medion editing. I think when you start, and then obviously cinematography. I think once you start racking up that many tech nominations, Best Picture is just like a natural go-to in that realm. So I would agree 100% with Janelle. I think Midnight Sky, I think we've kind of written it off as like, oh, because Clooney's last few movies just haven't hit in that director's spot the way we expect him to. He's also been nominated, by the way, in six different Oscar categories. Only one of three people to ever do that.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
well, couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
Yep.
Clayton, you and I are the only ones for prom getting Best Picture. Janelle's not with us.
I don't know. I have no idea.
And listen, she'd be 100% right.
Yeah. This
is not a hill I'm dying on. Time of recording, it's November 30th. We have five more months to go.
Yeah. And to be honest, there's so much competition.
Yeah.
That, like, I could absolutely see the prom getting in.
Okay.
I was going to say, I think, personally, I would take out Trial of Chicago 7 because I don't think it's as pressing and as urgent as it would have been, and I've said this before, had Biden not won the election. I think that I would take that out. And, yes, Sorkin will probably get a screenplay, but I think I'd put in The Five Bloods because I think more people will be like maybe right at the top of people's thinking because of Chadwick and Delroy Lindo too, who I think should totally deserves a Best Actor nomination.
The only reason I'm more on Trial of Chicago 7, I think it's probably the leading front runner for a SAG ensemble, and the actors branch is the largest branch of the Academy. So I think that...
The Five Bloods?
No, Trial of Chicago 7.
Chicago 7. Oh,
okay. The Five Bloods also has a really great... Actually, it just moderated a SAG Q&A for them. The Five Bloods has a really great cast, and I think that also can factor in. I think they're all in the top, 20 of contenders. Pieces of Woman, just to end there real quick. Pieces of Woman, if it was a year of five, is a textbook lone director selection that the director Cornel Mundrosko, I probably mutilated that, but Janelle's gonna just nod me along, that Cornel would feel like a lone director nominee, like the way Mike Lee got a nomination for Vera Drake, Bennett Miller for Foxcatcher, like that, those things tend to happen in the conversation around Pieces of Woman, besides Vanessa Kirby and Ellen Burstyn, is the 23 minute one take. And I think when that visionary director term gets thrown around, that usually follows with something. Think of Pawlikowski, Cold War.
Yeah.
Still one of the craziest things I think I've ever witnessed that he made it in the end for Cold War. All right. So with that, we have an upcoming interview with Chloe Zhao, Nomadland.
Yay!
The Woman of the Year, followed by another Woman of the Year, second, but she's still fantastic. Ariana DeBose from The Prom,
wonderful! What a breakout performance!
I'm so happy for her and just everything. Yeah. Like West Side Story next year, I'm just like cannot wait.
Watch out, world!
Can you imagine your first three movies being Hamilton, The Prom, and West Side Story? Bananas.
No, I can't.
Yeah. it wasn't yours, you know?
Just thinking.
All right. So yeah, for Variety Award Circuit, I'm Clayton with Janelle and Jazz, and enjoy the interviews. See you next week.
It's Variety's Award Circuit podcast, and I'm Jazz Tanke. Chloe Zhao is the critically acclaimed director behind The Rider and Songs My Brothers Taught Me. She had always wanted to make a road movie, especially one that looked at the American West. That was what attracted her to adapting the nonfiction book Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century by Jessica Bruder. The film stars Frances McDormand as Fern, a widow who has been left houseless after the gypsum mine that had propped up against the town of Empire closes for good. Fern leaves and travels through America in her white van, encountering other real-life nomads on her journey.
Okay, what we've got is parts and labor, $2,300 and tax.
I just looked up the value on your van. With that high a mileage, you're looking about $5,000 at the most.
I'd probably recommend taking that money and putting it towards a different vehicle.
Yeah, no, well, I can't do that. I can't do that, see, because, all right. I spent a lot of time and money building the inside out, and a lot of people don't understand the value of that, but it's not something like we can... I live in there. It's my home.
David Strathern and real-life nomads Linda May, Charlene Swanky, and Bob Wells also star. With the film's themes of unemployment, displacement, and moving cross-country, because of the coronavirus pandemic, Nomadland resonates deeply with these times. I recently spoke to Zhao about Nomadland, her budding friendship with McDormand, her busy schedule, and her fanfiction hobby. We began by discussing how she zeroed in on adapting the story of Nomadland.
Well, I've always wanted to make a road movie, and especially in the American West, because I spend a lot of time living in my cars and camping, sort of living a quite nomadic life, making my first two films. So when I read her book, when Fran and Peter came to me with Jessica's book, the amount of time that she has really focused on being with a nomadic community and really documenting the in and out of their daily lives and how they really, you know, in a year seasonally, how do they sustain that lifestyle and how do they form a community is really an really interesting character that she's captured. Like Swanky, Linda May, and Bob Wells. And so when I read the book, I thought, you know, obviously Fern is a fictional character that I made up with Fran. It doesn't exist in the book, but immediately we were like, how are we gonna, you know, how are we able to capture what Jessica has, you know, and create a character and be able to link them all together? Right away, it was like, this is gonna be an interesting challenge, but it's gonna be one that's worth it, you know?
Now, I remember when Frances gave you a shout out at the 2018 Spirit Awards. I was there in that room. And I think she called you like her new friend. Had you two already started discussing Nomadland?
Yeah, we did. And then we met, I think, for the first time just right before that. And I think we really hit it off. We had a long day just talking and brainstorming, and I think she said Chloe. I was like, oh, there could be many Chloes here, but no, we're not supposed to say anything yet. But then we were just both so excited, and it was hard to contain the excitement for sure. I think I said something too.
So. I remember that, and I love it.
That was a fun one, wasn't it? I know.
Oh my gosh. Back in the day when we could all gather in, you know, on the beach.
Back to the good old days, yeah.
So, you know, Songs My Brother Taught Me and The Rider, you know, you cast non-actors, which is something I love that gives your films a sense of realism. Can you talk about how you traveled across America to find your nomads for Nomadland?
But the cast in Nomadland was really a collaboration, you know, if I divided by three categories, and the first one would be what Jessica already included in her book. That was a big way into the community through the characters that she has met and many years has spent with them and again their trust. And the other 30% would be people. So in a way, they're from Fran's life as well, you know, people that she brought into the project. And then the other 30% are people that through my development process and just being on the road have met myself, and then the team had gone out randomly, you know, people that we captured because they just happened to be there, or we met them along the way and go, oh, you're interesting, come with us, or from my previous films.
Yeah. And you know, I can't not talk to you about Swanky. I mean, everybody who I talk to about Nomadland, the one thing that always comes out is Swanky and Swanky's monologue. What do you remember about meeting Swanky for the first time and the conversation that you had with her?
I think the first time I met her was when I drove to Linda May's land that she bought at a time in Douglas, New Mexico, or Arizona. I forgot, but the town's called Douglas. And Swanky just happened to be there, just chilling. And that's the first time I met her. But she and I really had one-on-ones. And when I went to Colorado, met with her at the parking lot of a Planet Fitness. And we spent a lot of time together. And that story was one of the first things she told me. She showed me the video of the swallow that was ended up being in the film. Almost right away, I thought that video is going to make it into the film. And we have to figure out a way how.
And, you know, whilst filming this, you didn't stay in, you know, hotels. You actually, you know, packed your bags and lived in an RV van. What was that experience like, you know, living in that confined space, being on the road, going across the America West?
I don't want to romanticize it because that's not what we did. We didn't do it every day. You know, we did it when we couldn't have access to motels and hotels. But when we did, we stayed in hotels. But it's very different to be able to sort of, you know, live a life according to your own schedule and be in that confined space with no access to plumbing or water. And it's another whole story where you have to meet the requirements of a film shoot. Be ready at a certain time. And so we could not afford to do that full time. So, you know, being in these hotels and motels that are on side of, usually outside of a gas station, and then sometimes parked outside, sometimes inside. Sometimes it's probably more comfortable in the van, RV, than some of the motels we stayed in. So it was a mixture of doing both, but the culture that we have established within our crew, you know, that is very similar to how a tribe of nomadic living would be. You know, we were very discreet and we were very much adjusting ourselves wherever we went. Depends on how people were like at that. In that area, how the weather was and what the location was like, we were just adjusting accordingly. So that's very similar to how you would travel as a tribe nomadically.
The one thing that's so beautiful is just this intimacy that you have with, you know, with the nomads. You know, you're going into the way they live. Like, how did you establish that trust, getting them to open up and talk about their lives and share their stories?
I think it's not that different than how I've done it in the past. You know, I think it's how you would get anybody to trust you and listen to you. Well, first of all, you listen. You know, don't go into with an idea of how you think you can change their lives and how you can make their lives better or what your agenda is. You know, you sort of sit down and you just say, just tell me your story. You know, I don't have an opinion. I want you to teach me something. That's the start. And then another thing I think is important is a lot of times that I find, especially in marginalized communities, people have a set of what they think they want, you might want to hear, you know, because a lot of times people do go to them with certain agenda. So they usually give you the spiel of the things they think you might want to hear about their struggle and their opinions. And I usually wait until that's over and ask things a bit more like, hey, and, you know, did you have a boyfriend in high school? And what's your favorite football team? And, you know, you get on that human level. And then the connection actually really starts. Because you are talking about things that you share, you have in common, not the things that divide you.
I mean, as I said, you know, the one thing I love is just how you capture the American West. Like, you know, I grew up in London. I've moved out here and just watching this film, it just, the freedom that you capture through your lens. Do you remember, like, because we don't have that, you know, I think we have the M25 and like the lonely country road.
You have some wild in the north. Like, I have recently been there. It's a different kind of wild.
It's a different, yeah. It's not as like free. It's not as freeing though as Voss. Like, do you remember the first time you wanted to explore the American West? Like, was there a movie or was there like a picture or just something that made you want to navigate that?
It was Aaron Huey is a photographer. It was some of the photos he did. I think he walked across America on foot with his dog. And he is for National Geographic. I think some of the photos were published in there. It was a very, very random encounter, really. Like, I saw these photos, and I don't know, something clicked for me. It was in South Dakota, these photographs on the reservation. I think he captured a time, I feel like, is in a capsule or something, you know, that it's a very specific time. People, there's a juxtaposition of their identity and the land that they're on. That juxtaposition is so, I don't see it elsewhere as often. You know, it just feels like there's such a strong cultural identity that's specifically American. And I was looking for that for sure. That's what first got me to get in a car from New York City to South Dakota.
I love that. I'm like, gosh, I need to do that one day. I was speaking to Joshua, and he's a Brit. And I was like, I've never done that. I kind of just want to do that after seeing this film. But
freedom does come with a price, you know? Everything from extreme heat to rattlesnake to tornadoes to all kinds of good stuff out there. But you know, if you look past that, it's also some of the most beautiful landscapes that I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah. Did you experience any like rattlesnakes and tornadoes? And
I think less so on this film because we were moving, but the few years I spent on the reservation in South Dakota, yeah, for sure. That land is wild, yeah.
Maybe I'll just stick to the city.
I have become a little more, I mean, we can get used to anything. I could be pulling ticks off of my face, you know, and I won't even blink. And now that I've been in California for 2 years now, if I see a spider in a bathroom, I'm like, oh my God. I think we get used to things really quickly. That's what the human beings, I bet if you go out there, you'd be fine.
All right. I'll let you know if I do it. And let you know how I cope. But you filmed this before the pandemic, and like its themes of unemployment, you know, Amazon being just so relied on, people packing their bags and just moving to, you know, cross country, or even just being like, I'm going to take a couple of days out or a week out to spend time with nature. And it resonates even more now. Were you surprised at how striking the film has become and how relevant it has become because of the pandemic?
I'm not super surprised. I think beyond that, there is something else. I showed the film to a director I really, really love and respect. And he mentioned something that made me think, oh, wow, I think this might work for some folks at this time. He said, I don't understand why I just love watching her doing laundry. I just love watching her making breakfast because she's like, because those are the things that I didn't think mattered, you know. But now in the morning I wake up and make breakfast and did laundry, but I accomplished something today, you know. I think because we have been told that we need to go so far and beyond those things to matter, you know. We gotta achieve so much to matter. When there was a time, chop wood and carry water is enough. You know, and then there is something about those little triumphs in life that we take for granted. And now we're forced to slow down and acknowledge them. I think that's also something that probably resonates with people.
I remember that at the beginning of the pandemic, it just made us realize how we were going like 100 miles per hour, not stopping. And then all of a sudden, you know, being forced into isolation and quarantine. It's like the little things that we didn't stop to realize really, you know, struck. But you didn't just adapt the book, you know, you didn't just direct it, you also took on the editing side of it too. Was that because of the lockdown, or had you decided pretty early on to that you were going to step in as editor?
Well, this movie, the way it was made, is very similar to how songs and the writer were made, you know, and I was involved in the editing process just as much as this one in the past. So I knew that I've always done the first pass of the film, and it, because it's almost like a rewriting process for me, finding the film in the amount of footage that we have. So for songs and writer, I was down the first pass, and I knew that I was going to do for this one. And as I was doing it, after the first cut and the second, I said, okay, I guess I can just keep going. I was thinking maybe I'll do the first pass and eventually we'll bring someone in. And maybe it's a mixture of the pandemic, and also it was really great working with people at Searchlight and my producing team. They were giving me great notes, and I was doing these, and it just didn't feel like we needed another person.
What I love is that whilst you were working on this, you were also working on The Eternals, another group of misfits. So what was it like creatively going from the Nomads, who are their own set of misfits, to The Eternals, superhero misfits as such?
Well, technically, there might be once or twice that I got those two mixed up in some of the meetings, which is actually very funny. They're like, no, I don't think that's this movie, Chloe. Oh, wait a minute. For like the visual effects review, things like that. And I was like, wait, that's, yeah. That happens. But other than that, they only have been really beneficial for me to work on these two films together. You know, when sometimes you get so locked into one thing, it's really nice to be able to force yourself to step out, to see, oh, there's a different world, there's a different way to be, and then come back and go, okay. You know, so creatively, it's been great. They keep each other in check.
Just going back to like growing up, like, was there a film that made you say, oh, this is what I want to be a part of, this is what I want to do? Or were there several films?
I think it was Wong Kar-wai's Happy Together, that the very first one that made me want to make films the certain way, you know. And it was the first time I thought, oh wow, you could say a lot more than what's just on screen, you know, like that you think you capture something, but there's so much more to it. Through how you put it together. That was Happy Together. And then some of the early Malick films had really strong influence on me as well. I think these are.
So I read that you used to write fan fiction. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to ask you who, because that's one of the things that, like, we know, I used to write.
I'm writing. Gee, that's the reason why it's anonymous.
That's the whole thing. Did you used to use LiveJournal? Because I used to write fan fiction, and it's like it was anonymous, but you never told people.
No, you never tell them your pen name, no. I've many people ask me since, but you would never find out. I just put it out there. LiveJournal is kind of, it was popular like a decade ago, maybe 15 years ago. I was using that all the time. But now it's like archive of our own, you know. You know what that is? That's kind of a good, really internationally recognized fan fiction site, and fanfiction.net is still going, but archive of our own is the one that I use.
But again, you'll never find out who.
You never find out what my pen name or what fandom I write in.
But do you share it amongst like close friends? Because I have like three or four people that you don't.
Oh, you do? Oh, good for you. You have friends you can trust. No, because it's not that I don't trust my friends. It's such a huge part of my life. it's even when I was a kid at the time, there were, I wasn't like making movies or anything. You know, I hear stories of people in when they're kids, they're using little VHS and Super 8 making film. No, I was, for me, my creative outlet was drawing comic books and manga and writing fan fiction, put them online and getting feedbacks, you know, and feeling like, oh, I can connect with someone else through telling a story. And that was such a big part of my life. But it also has a lot, you know, it's very personal. You don't hide anything because you could do whatever you want in that world. And that's not something I'm ready to share with the world.
I get it completely. It's like a very, you know, you'll read the comments and it's like, wow, this person really likes what I'm writing, but they don't know who I am. And they felt it's a great dive.
But you think about that in the film that you do put out in the world, into the world. Mm-hmm. I constantly think about how much am I navigating, how much I'm willing to share of who I am into these films. You know, a lot of directors are much more braver. I think they put a lot of themselves out there. You know, I think I'm a little bit more protective.
Fanfiction.net, such memories. But then they killed Life Journal. We're not going to spend the rest of the podcast talking about
it's still going for Life Journal. I still occasionally visit some old ones, but some of them are deleted. Yeah, different time.
You just deleted 30 chapters that I wrote.
Oh, so glad you know what we're talking about.
Well, of course. It's a nice outlet, as you say. So let's talk about, let's comment about the LGBTQ storyline that's going to be told in the Eternals, because representation really matters. You know, not only are you dealing with a diverse cast, you're dealing with a storyline that's rarely told in big action movies. What was that like to explore that, and what can you say about it? I know, you know, there's only so much you're allowed to say, but within that little tiny box?
You know, I think the way we're very lucky to have an incredible actor to portray that role. And I think for us, it's really about looking at Festus, his character as an individual first. He is before anything else that defines him, he is a unique individual with his own, you know, pleasures and pains and struggles that's, to me, that's the most important thing, is that that's how I want to treat him. That's how we want to treat him. And that's how we, you know, when we talk about him as a character, that goes first. So, It's as much as I can say, you know. I think it's important, and that goes with Nomadland, and also, you know, making films on the reservation. To me, it's like human first. I want to treat them not as a issue or a political agenda. I want to portray a unique individual first, and you can get to know them through that lens. And everything else comes as the icing on the cake.
What has it been like to have Nomadland come out in this, you know, this new landscape of drive-ins and virtual, you know, the virtual world of doing press and people seeing it virtually?
I think in terms of the press is something else. You know, I do miss being in the space with everyone, but it's also nice to just not have to be in my pajamas at the same time. But in terms of viewing the film, I'm just so grateful that that people have the need to somehow connect with each other through this. You know, if anything, this time has taught us is that we're not going to be stopped. You know, we're going to find a way to connect with each other. That's really nice to know, whether it's through drive-ins or putting up theaters in the shopping mall parking lot, you know, or doing it online. We're gonna keep going. I do miss the movie theater, and I do hope that we, as you know, we preserve them as much as possible and support that theatrical experience, because there's nothing like it, you know, being in a space that's dark and quiet, which is something some outdoor screenings can't give you. Sorry, my dogs are making noise. And then seeing it all, you know, just one screen. And I do hope we got a chance to see Nomadland that way. People get a chance to do that safely, of course.
Yeah. Amazing. Chloe Zhao, thank you so much for joining us on this week's episode of the Variety Award Circuit podcast. It was such a pleasure talking to you.
Likewise.
Nomadland hits theaters on December 4. Tony-nominated Broadway star Ariane DeBose is now ready to tackle the features world in a big way. Not only does she boast a breakout role in Ryan Murphy's Netflix musical The Prom, but will next be seen in Steven Spielberg's updated version of West Side Story. Variety's Clayton Davis recently spoke with DeBose about working on The Prom, queer representation, and more.
How did this fall into your lap? How did you get involved with everything?
Well, it literally fell into my lap. I was working on West Side Story, and I got a call asking me to come in, and I had seen the show, which I loved, and I laughed, I cried a lot, and I loved that I saw a young woman of color up there, like getting to the opportunity to tell her coming out story, because I do think that we see so many coming out stories, but none of them have a face of color attached to it. So I went in and I did my best. And honestly, I thought I was not getting the job. I literally called my agent and was like, don't expect to hear anything, not going my way. And then Ryan asked to meet with me, and then I got the job. So just the craziest thing of life. It was weird.
Not amazing. And you get to work with everyone that's ever worked in Hollywood that's talented and amazing and incredible. And then you and Joelle and Pellman are just these two, and I would say these discoveries, people have been learning your name coming up for a little bit, but you guys are these two discoveries thrust into this world. How did that feel? What did that first day of filming feel like for you?
You know, it was sort of, it felt like an out-of-body experience every day, you know? I mean, I definitely grew up watching these faces on my TV screens and on film screens. And so then when you walk on set and, you know, there's James Corden and, oh, hi, Miss Meryl Streep, that's your face. It's very strange. You don't think it's real. And then the longer you keep showing up, it does become very real. But I think what normalized it was just their humanity, right? Like they were so warm with us and tried to include us in their conversations on set. Even when we had no idea what they were talking about, they still made space. I remember my first day on set, I said I was just very expensive background because Miss Merrill was doing It's Not About Me. And that was such a cool opportunity to just watch her process, watch her work. And it really was fascinating. But I was sitting there for one of her takes, and you clap for Meryl Streep when she finishes the take, because she's Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
And I clapped every single time. And then the one time that I like saw something on my skirt and was trying to fix it, I look up and she's right here and she goes, "You're not clapping. Was it not good?" I felt so Priestley'd. Like, I felt like I got burned by Miranda Priestley in the face. I started sweating immediately and just got on the floor and bowed and said, "I'm sorry."
Genuflected. You were like, "I'm so sorry." Oh,
so sorry. You're amazing. I thought it was great. I have no notes. what do you do? And then we laughed about it. And she was like, "No, darling, I'm so happy to see you. I didn't recognize you in the look. Oh my gosh, she was just nice and warm, and it was great." I have a small affinity with Miranda Priestley as a character, so it was kind of a wonderful moment for me.
Oh my God. So it felt like being back on So You Think You Can Dance for a second, but the roles were reversed and you were giving your notes for Meryl. That's good.
Oh, definitely. So many notes. Said no one ever.
Okay. So you were born in North Carolina, not from New York. I think everyone had a fair assumption you were from New York, but it's just because you got this, the flavor always comes, like, you know, especially
swag. With
swag, yeah. Got New York swag. And you identify as Afro-Puerto Rican, and your mother is Italian. You say
my mother's white. My mother's super white. In a wonderful way. Super white in such a great way.
Yeah.
I want to clarify that for everybody. Sure. Yes, I identify as Afro-Latina. My father is Puerto Rican. My mother is white. And for me, I just feel like this trail mix of many, many, many things. My people come from, you know, we have ties to, you know, the Cherokee Nation, you know, Europe. Yeah, my last name is DuBose, formerly Dubois. So there's a lot of different things going on there. But at the end of the day, I still always describe myself, I'm Afro-Latina, and my mother is white, so that makes me biracial or multiracial in that way.
Yeah. And the reason why I asked that specifically, I think maybe this is why I've had felt like a really good connection and affinity to you, because I'm also Puerto Rican, I'm Puerto Rican and Black, but me and my sister, one of my sisters especially, she, you know, we're both Puerto Rican, but we are both different shades of Puerto Rican, right? My sister is very, very dark skin, and we used to walk down the street all the time and people would never believe that we were brother and sister. Mm-hmm. And this kind of friction that exists within Latino culture, Latinx culture, as now we try to be more inclusive, is that people don't understand that we are just, like, how do you, you can't generalize a population of 500 million people. You just can't, you know, we're from all parts of the world. And even though Puerto Rico is our island, my family's from Loíza, which is where they used to drop off all the slaves from Africa.
Right.
There are like a lot of dark people there. Have you dealt with that kind of internal struggle within your own culture about who you are, and then trying to, I don't say justify that to people who see you as one thing when you're so much more than that?
Oh yes. It's my entire existence in a way. In fact, I was talking about it last night with a friend, and it's an ongoing process to reconcile the fact that there, especially in my childhood, I was in a very loving community, but I didn't necessarily see myself, right? And so many people are like, well, you're this or you're that. My entire career has been that, like people trying to put me in boxes, the assumption that I'm African-American and that, or that I am super well-versed in one culture over another, and the relationship to whiteness versus Blackness. It's really complicated. Because at the end of the day, I don't believe someone like you or I actually has to justify our identity. We are who we are. When you speak to, you know, the friction within the Latinx community, I see it. I've struggled with it for a long time. In fact, West Side Story was one of the first times that I got to be enveloped in the culture and really just truly feel accepted. And I felt more myself amongst that group of people because of what we were doing. We were united under a banner. And, you know, I, in a perfect world, would love to see us unite under the banner of Spectrum Grace. Because you're right, you cannot just boil down what it is to be Latina or Latino in one thing. And I think that's what's been interesting about observing the industry. It's like Rita Moreno, my queen, she's also been the standard, and it's a very specific look, which hasn't necessarily allowed for what this is to be considered Puerto Rican. And so that's why in this moment when Steven Spielberg looked at me and was like, I would like you to play Anita, I was both afraid of it and so excited by it. Yeah. Because there's never been anybody who said yes to letting this be Puerto Rican. In fact, people are like, wait, you're Latino? You're Latina? Like, yeah, so Latina. It like comes out like just like a word vomit. Puerto Rican. So it the journey of identity is one that I'm still on, right? And trying to invite people to join the conversation in a way that's conducive, especially during the pandemic. You had asked about the pandemic and, you know, in the conversation around Black Lives Matter and everything, it's like Afro Latinx people, we're a part of that conversation. Mm-hmm. And I want to encourage our brothers and sisters to join it, because when we walk down the street, we're Black. And the delineation between whether you're Latino or not does not matter. In fact, the delineation of whether my mother is white doesn't matter for me. Yeah. So it's that whole thing of like, no, we actually all, we have more in common than we have not. And our uniqueness is our strength. So I'm personally, I hope I can continue this conversation around Spectrum Grace for the next year. It's like my whole hashtag, Spectrum Grace.
two last questions for you. One, we spoke about this. I interviewed you very quickly a few weeks back about the prom, Alyssa Green, and what she embodies, and not just from a Latin Latinx representation, but a queer character on screen. Again, not being able to see that coming out. You spoke about that briefly. That part of the story being spoken to our community, Black and Latino community.
And Latinos.
Well, yeah, mm-hmm. What does that mean to you for that part and your personal connection with it?
You know, I think specifically for young people who identify as LGBTQ, Black and Latino, I think seeing Alyssa Green go through this process and find a happy ending gives a lot of young people a lot of hope. Because there is, unfortunately, a lot of homophobia that runs rampant within the Black and Brown communities. It's just a fact. And it's hard. It's hard for people to feel like they're letting their families down. Like when you're talking about Latinos and you're talking about, you know, Black communities, very family oriented, very much talking about like, we are so proud of who we are. We're proud of what we represent, how hard we're working, all of these different things. There's a standard of excellence that's set in both communities. And somehow along the way, being gay or lesbian or trans has become something that is less than. Like it is a marginalized group of people. So I'm hoping that when you see this girl go on this journey, and she's no different. She is smart. She is kind. People like her. You know what I mean? Like she's the student body president, you know? And she's a, you see her manifest in a beautiful young girl. She just happens to want to be with another girl. That doesn't make her a bad person. It doesn't make her evil. It's just part of her. It's like, we need to be just loving each other. Like there's been so much divisive rhetoric for so long. It's like the choosing to discriminate against a person based on who they love or how they want to identify is old. We have to move past it. It's the only way we change things within our communities. And having this mother-daughter duo, I'm so grateful I had Kerry Washington to do this beside, because she was like, no, let's have this conversation. Let's go for it. And the coming out scene, it's not pretty. You watch a young girl take a stand and you watch a parent go, talk about it later. Mm. It hurts. That is the norm. But when you watch these two make space for each other, and you watch Alyssa have the courage to invite her parent to the table, to come back to the table, I hope that that is a template for a lot of young people who come from these communities who are filled with such pride, or you know, these communities that still have these issues of homophobia. You know what I'm saying? Like, that probably wasn't as poetic as it could have been, but that's the crux of it.
The Prom streams on Netflix beginning December 4. And that's it for this edition of Variety's Award Circuit podcast. Preston Northrup edited this episode and Michael Schneider is the producer. Be sure to subscribe to the Award Circuit podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. And also head to Variety.com and click on the Award Circuit tab to find the latest Oscar predictions and key races, as well as your daily fix of news, analysis, and reviews. For Janelle Riley, Clayton Davis, and Michael Schneider, I'm Jazz Tanke, and we'll see you on the circuit.